The Guardian.
Hi, Pod fans, it's Max here. Just to say that Philippe Auclair's audio quality improves immeasurably after the section on Liverpool. It is nothing about his feelings towards Liverpool. It was a technical problem. The rest of the podcast you hear, Philippe, in pure golden quality. Everything he says is always quality. The audio quality will be glorious from about 10 minutes in. Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly, the second half of the Premier League preview. I hope you enjoyed the first one, including why is no one talking about Liverpool? Isn't Van Dijk like a new signing? Can City reclaim the title? Pauses to check they won it last year. How will Grealish fit in? What's a good season for Manchester United? What can we expect from Jadon Sancho? What, apart from blind faith, has led me to predicting a fifth place finish for Spurs? Can we get 5 minutes out of Wolves? Has Barry remembered about Southampton this time? And can anyone match John Bruin for interesting facts about football teams? All that, a little bit on the Super Cup, your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Barry Glendenning, welcome.
Hello.
Philippe Auclair, bonjour, ça va?
Ça va très bien, bonjour à toi.
The Racing Post's Mark Langdon, hello.
Hi, Max.
Barry, did we say at the start of this pod that we would give a fact about Burnley, because we all forgot to give a fact about Burnley? And if we did, have you got a fact about Burnley? or is this something that we'll do on Monday's pod and perhaps run through the whole season?
I thought you were doing one. I haven't got one.
Okay. Well, Burnley fans, we promise to do it on Monday. Right, before we...
We could wait for the first international break and just devote an entire podcast to interesting facts about Burnley.
Burnley, aren't they the only club in history to have a pub named after their manager? Their current manager, the Die Charms.
Yeah, right.
Is that interesting enough?
I quite like the idea of forgetting every pod to think of a fact about Burnley until about 2024. Anyway, let's do a bit on the Super Cup. Chelsea won, Villarreal won. Chelsea won 6-5 on penalties. There was some chat in the WhatsApp group about should we watch it, did it matter, what are we going to do? But Philippe, you ended up quite enjoying this football match.
I did, actually. And I did it in no small measure thanks to Villarreal, actually, who really took this game very seriously. I mean, I think Unai Emery has got a pretty wretched record when it comes to that particular competition, little rabbit ears here. And they were obviously very, very much up for it and pretty much with a full strength team as well, apart from their keeper who had been struck down by COVID. And they really, really came back very well into the game after an excellent opening by Chelsea and an opening which included that goal by Ziyech, and more about Ziyech in a minute, by the way. And it didn't feel like one of those occasions where people are just going through the motions. The two teams were really going for the trophy. We saw some good football. Villarreal's goal was absolutely magnificent. And then we saw a reenactment of the famous Van Gaal substitution as well, just before the penalty. So what more can you ask for a Super Cup?
What I really wanted was Thomas Tuchel to bring Kepa on and then find Willy Caballero. I have no idea where he didn't appear to be on the bench, and then try and sub Kepa off just to see how he would feel.
Barry, I think Willy Caballero has left the club, Max, so it might have been difficult.
That was that moment. Would have been better if Mendy would have refused to have come off.
Yeah.
That would have been a wonderful turn.
That was that moment in the League Cup final when everybody looked at the bench and everyone was like, Rob Green plays for Chelsea? Oh, there he is. But anyway, Kepa did his job. You know, in many ways, I felt like the Chelsea players, Mark, were really delighted for Kepa in that moment.
Yeah, I mean, he's had a rough time, I think it's fair to say, since his huge money transfer, from Spain. I think most of the criticism has been deserved. He's made a lot of mistakes, and when you're the Chelsea goalkeeper and you make that many mistakes, you are going to receive the flak, and a lot of them were, just clearly his fault. No getting away from that, but I think that Thomas Tuchel has tried to keep him involved maybe more than, once Mendy came in, there was a clear kind of right, Kepa, you're out. But I think Tuchel recognises that he does need two goalkeepers. And so, he's keeping them both interested and giving them enough game time. I mean, we'll never know what would have happened if Mendy would have stayed in goal, of course. But I do remember in the League Cup game, I think it may even have been his debut away to Tottenham last season, when he just dived the wrong way for all of the Spurs penalties. So maybe that was sort of in the minds of the sort of Chelsea goalkeeping coaches. And of course, Petr Cech is somebody that takes a keen interest, I think, in stats as well. So he may have had a bit of input as well.
What we don't want is a Chelsea-Manchester United penalty shootout with Mendy and De Gea, because it would go on forever. We'd just be there. We couldn't do anything. The world would stop. I did love N'Golo Kante walking out holding the trophy, because the trophy is slightly bigger than N'Golo Kante. You mentioned Ziyech. That is a real shame for him, because I think he's a wonderful footballer. He looked so good at Ajax, didn't he? And I think we wanted him to push on this season. And Tuchel described that injury as serious. And the only other thing I thought, Barry, is what is the point of extra time in this game? I mean, like, I'm still dubious about cup finals before the season started. I know there's no other time to put this, really, but we don't need extra time for these poor chaps, do we?
No, probably not. I mean, I'm not a fan of extra time at all. I don't really see the point of it. I think if games are level after 90 minutes, just go straight to penalties, whatever the competition. But I watched the Olympic final, which went to extra time, and some of the players could barely walk. They were so exhausted. Obviously, the Olympics coming at the end of a long season, many of the games were played in horrendous heat. The final was played at night, but even so, it was still very hot, and the players were just dead on their feet. It seemed almost cruel to put them through extra time.
And let's begin the Premier League preview, shall we? Liverpool, the first one. They're away to Norwich at Saturday, 5:30. Third last year. Their manager is Jurgen Klopp. I like these bits of admin. They've signed Ibrahima Konate, a centre-back from RB Leipzig. But Philippe, you know, getting Van Dijk and Gomez back is...
Go on, say it, Max. Say it. You know you want to.
They're like new signings. Sean says... why is virtually no one predicting Liverpool to be anywhere near the league title? The squad's basically the same as the one that won it with 99 points. I think it's interesting that because they haven't really been involved in the transfer gossip, no one is talking about them.
It might be something. I think the logical explanation would be the relative depth of the squads. And when you're looking at title contenders, and obviously I think everybody will have put, you know, Liverpool in their top four or top five. But then you start looking at what might distinguish one team from the next, and you think, well, you do think that Liverpool are still perhaps short in a creative midfielder, for example, you know that Van Dijk and Gomez are coming back, but you don't know exactly at what kind of level they're going to perform. There's the very slight as well criterion, which is that they will be impacted by the African Cup of Nations, which take place between, I think, 9 January and 6 February. And the players from Liverpool who will go there will miss 4 games, probably, because they won't, and maybe even 5. So we're talking about Mohamed Salah and obviously and Sané here, so two very important players. Put all that together and you think, they'll be there or thereabouts, but they won't be top. And I think it's a case perhaps of not being as excited about Liverpool as we've been in previous seasons. And in my case, as well, thinking that I see them more likely to do something in Europe again than in England, given the relative strength of the contenders for the title.
Now I've listened to that, Philippe. Can I change where I've predicted them to finish? Mark, what do you reckon?
Yeah, I agree basically completely with what Philippe just said there about Liverpool. They can win the league because they've got a great starting 11 and a great manager, but they probably need more to go right for them than, say, Chelsea and Manchester City, you know, purely because of the depth of squad that those two have got. I suppose another question mark, less from me, but I know that other people have kind of doubted whether that front three is as good as what it was of 2 years ago. And now Jota comes in and gives a new dimension to that attack, possibly. But, you know, when they won the league, that front three were just incredible, particularly I think the way that, you know, Firmino, even though he didn't score the goals, linked the play together. Henderson's a couple of years on from where he was at that stage. I would question whether they've got enough depth in midfield, because Wijnaldum, again, he wasn't necessarily somebody that you needed to have in that starting 11, but what a great player, if he wasn't in the starting 11, to be next one off the rank. And if the midfield three is going to be Henderson, Fabinho and Thiago, which is a fine midfield, where are the next ones coming from? I don't think you can rely on Naby Keita, because his fitness and form just hasn't been there. Potentially Harvey Elliott, who had a great loan spell with Blackburn last year. But, you know, Klopp's looking at his bench, and we're talking about Harvey Elliott. Pep Guardiola looks at his bench, and it could be Foden, Sterling, Grealish and any number of others. And, you know, Chelsea, we saw with their Super Cup bench last night as well. You know, the depth of kind of, I suppose, the two that are seen as more likely to win the league is just greater than what Jurgen Klopp's working with.
Barry, any extra thoughts on Liverpool, or do you just want to deliver the fascinating fact that you've been tasked to find about this football club?
I don't have a great huge amount to add, really. Curtis Jones, I suppose, is someone who might make the breakthrough he has been threatening to make. I'm really worried about my Liverpool fact, because it's very possible I'm the only person in the world who didn't know this. But I only discovered it yesterday, and it blew my tiny little mind. So apologies if everyone else is well aware of this fact. But Thiago Alcantara do Nascimento is the brother of Paris Saint-Germain's Rafinho, Rafael Alcantara do Nascimento, the PSG midfielder. And the pair are sons of Mazzino, a.k.a. Oimar do Nascimento, who won the World Cup with Brazil in 94, the Copa America in 1989, and an Olympic silver medal in Seoul in 1988. And their mother, Mazzino's ex-wife, Valeria Alcantara, was an exceptional volleyball player in her day.
I've put Liverpool second, and I regret it. Mark, where are you putting them?
At third.
Barry?
Third.
Philippe?
Fourth.
Okay, they're Manchester City. Last season, they won the title. Their manager is Pep. They're away to Spurs on Sunday, a 4:30 kickoff. Jack Grealish has come in. Harry Kane may come in or may not come in. You can have the Harry Kane caveat in where you want to put them in the league. De Bruyne is going to miss the start of the season. Phil Foden is going to miss the start of the season as well. But as we've said, Barry, their depth is extraordinary, and you, I hope Grealish just slots in beautifully, because he's such a lovely footballer.
Yeah, and he probably will adapt. It may take time, though, because playing for Manchester City is going to be a completely different proposition to playing for Villa. Teams will sit back and defend en masse, and it will be up to him to try and pick a way through those defences, and that's going to be a lot more difficult. But I imagine he will adapt pretty comfortably. I do think £100 million is a ridiculous amount of money for a player of his quality. I mean, he's good, but I suppose you are worth whatever anyone's willing to pay for you.
Well, it was his release clause, so they didn't have a choice. If they wanted him, they had to pay that release clause, which is a little bit unusual in English football, I must say.
Where are the holes with City? You know, where could it fall down if it does?
I don't think there are any real holes. I think you're still... There's the eternal question of, oh, what do they do when Fernandinho is no longer there? But he is still there. Yeah. And when he goes, there will be a Fernandinho-shaped hole in their midfield. But otherwise, my goodness, the depth is so impressive. I mean, we're talking about a club which has got means at its disposal, which are so out of reach to the others, that they spent on one academy player who came from Fluminense, Kaiki, which they recruited this summer. Nobody has talked about it, but they spent, you know, something like the equivalent of 10 million euros, 8.5 million quid, on an academy player. That's a lot of money. Many clubs haven't spent that kind of money of any player at the moment. Even if Jack Grealish is very expensive, in a way, I think that's a kind of player that Pep Guardiola was missing. particularly in very static position situations where they're pressing, they've got 11 players behind the ball in front of them, and you want a player who is capable of finding, threading balls, finding holes, dribble. Also, obviously, very importantly, get free kicks, which he's the best at in the country and perhaps in Europe, and give them a little bit of a little extra unpredictability. And I'm wondering, as far as his role is concerned, even though it will be on the opposite side of the field, if it's not the role that Pep Guardiola was hoping Bernardo Silva could have, which he never quite got up to in terms of the trenchant of his attacking ability. And I think he's going to slot in extremely well in that kind of inside forward position on the left-hand side or as a number 10. And it's a frightening prospect. It's also, in terms of pure football, it's a lovely prospect to see what Jack Grealish can do with a team that has the possession of the ball.
Yeah, and actually he was making a point in that press conference he did that, you know, at Villa, people often doubled up on him. And, well, you can't, if you double up on Grealish at City, then someone else... You know, you're giving a lot of space to Riyad Mahrez or whoever. Mark, to Harry Kane or not to Harry Kane?
I think they're going to struggle to get Harry Kane because I think Tottenham are unmoved in what they consider his sort of value to be with 3 years left on the contract. And I'm not sure that City will want to go as far as what sort of Tottenham are trying to push them. It also feels a bit of sort of an ego battle now between the two where you don't want to lose it. You know, Daniel Levy, if he sells him for 100 million or just over 100 million, will feel like he's lost and he's not that type of person that likes to lose these transfer battles. And I think City will feel sort of taken advantage of if they have to pay sort of, you know, what would be considered, I think, over the top fee for Harry Kane. So they may well go into it without sort of, you know, a recognised proper number nine. I don't think that's too much of an issue. Aguero barely played for them last season. He wasn't, a major reason why they won the league so comfortably. Jesus, I'm not his biggest fan. I think he does a lot of good things, but maybe isn't quite that finisher. But they'll just get enough goals from everywhere, I think, to win the league, even without Kane.
I'm giving them the title, Barry.
I have them second.
Philippe?
I've given them the title as well.
And can you give us an interesting fact, Philippe, about Manchester City?
Yeah, and it's probably a fact that is known by most Manchester City fans, but it's still quite remarkable. The oldest player who ever played for Manchester City is John Budgie Burridge, the spectacular and colourful goalkeeper who... played at Manchester City at the age of 43 years and 4 months. But the extraordinary thing about it was his debut for the club. He came on as a sub at half-time, and he made his debut for Man City at the age of 43 years. And what is perhaps also very surprising is that this didn't happen in the mists of yesteryear, but as late as April 1995 in a game against Newcastle. So that's my exciting fact about Manchester City.
I enjoyed it and gives me a whole gear to become the reserve keeper. Scott Carson has that sort of nailed down, doesn't he? That's a gig, isn't it? Third keeper at City. What a joy that is. Manchester United then came second last year. Solskjaer's the manager. Home against Leeds, which is a great early kickoff on Saturday, isn't it? 12:30. They brought in Jadon Sancho and Tom Heaton. Arguably, Sancho will have a bigger impact. Mark, what are your thoughts about how Manchester United brought in? Varane is
on the
coming.
Verge.
He's on the verge. Rafael Varane, yeah, from Real Madrid. And despite lots of people saying, I don't think Varane can cut it in this league. that's the most dismissive face I've ever seen you pull, Mark. How do you think United will fare?
Well, the last one I saw was that, you know, Ben White would be a better signing because he was used to the Premier League. Completely dismissing the Champions League and World Cups that Rafa Varane has won. I mean,
that was Sean Wright Phillips, wasn't it?
It was. I mean, I've got no doubts that he'll slot in absolutely fine in that Manchester United back four, will improve them. You know, he's a better player than Lindelof and Bailly. So no issues there. I think Sancho, the numbers he was putting up as, you know, a teenager, quite remarkable really in the Bundesliga, still 21, and I think will just develop into one of the best sort of wide forwards in the world if he's not already up there. So I think that United have had a good transfer window. I still think that there would be areas of concern. I think central midfield, whether McTominay or Fred can sort of really hold down that one defensive position, because it sounds like they're going to change formation and that Solskjaer is looking to move away from using both of those holders. The future of Paul Pogba remains sort of undecided, and I think it's important to get that done. But the biggest concern for me, and it's something that's been there for a couple of years, so it's not new, it's the manager and whether he's able to sort of overcome the Klopp, Tuchel and Pep Guardiola, who are three of the best around. And Solskjaer does, I think he's done many good things at Manchester United in terms of bringing that unitedness back and the connection with the supporters. But is he able to win them a title in this kind of competitive field? And that would be my biggest doubt, really, because he's not at that level. And I'm not sure he ever will get to that level. And you saw what happened when Chelsea replaced kind of a club legend with a high-ranking manager and sort of the uplift that they got from that. And people said that Chelsea couldn't defend under Frank Lampard. And now, of course, under Chelsea, under Tuchel, it's completely different. You know, last season, they outperformed their expected goals scored more than any other team in the Premier League. And that is going to be difficult to replicate. And I just think that until they sort that manager position out, they're going to fall just a little bit short every time. And, you know, the United fans that are sort of pro Ole are scratching their heads as to why their form is up and down at times. And there's sort of a great performance followed by, you know, this little inconsistent spell. And, I mean, it's pretty obvious, I think, to me, why that is.
Baz?
Yeah, I have reservations about Ole as well. I'm not sure what constitutes success for some United fans. You know, there's some I know who thought finishing second was last season was absolutely fine, but I think Manchester United should have greater aspirations for that. And then I also have reservations about the owners, the Glazers. I don't think they care about winning trophies as long as they qualify for the Champions League every season. But is that enough for United fans? I just don't know, really. Again, I'm not sure Ole will last the season. If they go on a bad run and it looks like they might finish outside the top four, I think that could be him done for. It probably would have helped him hugely to win the Europa League.
Solskjaer, it is difficult, even if you had a brilliant manager at Manchester United, Philippe, to compete with Pep and Tuchel especially, because, you know, your resources are good, but not quite as good.
I would qualify that. I think that in terms of squad depth, they've got a magnificent squad, a really magnificent squad. And they haven't lost any, you know, players of note. They've reinforced very well. We should remember that their second half to the season, last season, was pretty damn good. What we don't know is that if the kind of really kind of pragmatic, slow football, but effective football that Solskjaer made his team play last season will perhaps be as efficient in a completely different context, i.e. Not post-COVID, unfortunately, but post-empty stadiums, where, you know, there was very little pressure. It was a completely different type of pressure put on the teams. And in a way, Solskjaer's approach was well suited, I think, to the times. But when I look at that squad, I'm thinking, my goodness, this is a squad that should be going for the league, the league title, without a doubt. I would really like to see how Mason Greenwood is going to evolve. He's an absolutely superb finisher. Is he going to play now in a number nine position? Or is he going to fight it out with Edinson Cavani, play from wide, and so on? I mean, they've got, the defense is going to be very important, obviously, for them. And they've got Rafael Varane now. And you think Varane, Maguire, that's pretty serious. That is potentially one of the best duos in the Premiership. So I'm actually strangely optimistic for them. That doesn't mean I think they're going to win the title. But I think that despite Solskjaer's limitations, and by the way, why on earth did Manchester United extend his contract when he still had 1 year to run? and giving him all these possible, you know, all these players, and not wait until to see what happened with that. But despite of all that, I think there will be a really tough team to beat. And also they will do something that Alex Ferguson's teams used to do, which is perhaps struggle a little bit against the Manchester Cities and the Chelseas, or maybe even the Leeds United, but absolutely crush the rest, which is one way that Fergie, you know, got his team to win the title on quite a few occasions. So I am optimistic for them, Max. And you're going to ask me, where do I see them?
Yeah,
the
I've got them fourth. You?
Two.
Second. Barry?
Fifth.
Mark?
Fourth.
Well, an eyebrow raised from Mark with Barry.
No, I really like the call. I'm intrigued that most people seem to have the sort of the big four, if you like, that sort of in the top four. So it's good to hear Barry's got a different view to that.
Is it Leicester that you had fourth?
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting fact on Manchester United from Mark before we end part one.
Yeah, so I'm going for the fact that Ole Gunnar Solskjaer has been in charge for 151 games, during which time they've had 49 penalties awarded for them.
Wow.
That's basically one in every three games.
Well, Fernandes is worth it, isn't it? Just for that, I guess. Right, that'll do for part one. Part two, we begin with Newcastle United. Welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. For the very few of you who are listening to this before the live show, and actually you can watch the live show on catch up for the next week. So if you don't watch it on Thursday night at 7:30 because you're listening to this after that has happened, it's me, Barry, Philippe and Wilson. There is a halftime spectacular. It involves a small amount of fancy dress. Who knows what story Barry will tell during this one, but I'm looking forward to it. theguardian.com/guardianlive. Come along or watch later and pretend it's live, whatever you like. Robot of Death writes, no team from N to Z has won the top division since Nottingham Forest in 1978. Before that, it was Spurs in 61. What's the matter with them? It's a very good point, isn't it? Alphabetically challenged the rest of the teams in this division. Newcastle United came 12th last year. Steve Bruce, the manager, home to West Ham on Sunday at 2:00. So one set of fans will be moaning a lot at 4:00 on Sunday. Signings, none. Joe Willock are there. It looked like Joe Willock was over the line. Not quite sure now. Barry, what do you think?
Oh, I think I'd rather not have to comment on them at all, because no matter what you say, you're going to get slaughtered. I don't think they'll have a particularly good season. They've avoided relegation comfortably last season. Their fans are completely pessimistic for the season ahead. They will be back in the stadium. They will be giving Steve Bruce shed loads of abuse. I don't think he's a particularly good manager, but I don't think he is as bad as most Newcastle fans think either. They consider him to be a dinosaur, and last season he tried to rectify that by bringing in Graham Jones as a coach. Graham Jones, who was also part of the England setup for the Euros. So now anything good Newcastle do, Bruce gets no credit. It's given, the credit goes to Jones or the players or anyone but Bruce, even though it was him who brought Jones in. Anything bad they do, Bruce gets all the blame, and I don't think that's fair. Having said that, I'm not optimistic about their chances at all. They may well avoid relegation because there will be three worse teams than them, but I don't think it will be anything particularly inspiring they do in the field. Will Callum Wilson score more goals for them? Or will he score enough goals? I don't know. Ryan Fraser had a disappointing first season there last year. Hopefully he'll sort of get going. But I wouldn't be hugely optimistic about their chances of doing anything impressive.
Callum Wilson was talking about Steve Bruce and Graham Jones, and he said, I think Graham coming in definitely complimented the manager because he's a little more tactically aware and up to date. The manager has different strengths and attributes. Towards the end of last season, we had more of a style and a philosophy. That is a bit of a kick, isn't it, on Steve Bruce? Anyway, I think you sort of summed up pretty well there, Baz. I mean,
the one thing people forget as well, last season Newcastle got absolutely decimated by a COVID outbreak in the camp that floored Alan Saint-Maximum and Jamal Lascelles in particular. Alan Saint-Maximum obviously is their one really exciting player, the one guy who'll get fans out of their seats, but that wasn't factored into some of their dismal performances last season either.
Philippe, can you give Newcastle fans some hope?
No, not really. As long as this ownership situation is not resolved one way or another, the atmosphere will remain the same, which means the atmosphere is irrespirable. I cannot see any reason to be particularly excited. I see more reasons to be worried and seriously worried. Yes, they survived last year, but my goodness, in such a fashion that honestly, it would have been better. I mean, it's almost like a slow crash happening. Oh, yes, they managed to slow down a little bit before hitting the wall, but that wall's got to be hit at some point.
Are you saying Newcastle United should be put down?
No, I wouldn't say that. That would be a terrible thing to say. And you know, I was going to use this terrible expression: the fans deserve better. But in this particular case, they certainly do, actually. But the ownership issue is the one that will determine absolutely everything, and I can't see there's going to be any progress about that. Yeah. I mean, I think the only good news is that Andy Carroll is out of contract.
Mark, can you give us an interesting fact, please?
Yes, I'm not quite sure why the Newcastle fans are moaning so much, because I've got them top of one particular table that I think they should be very proud of, actually. Last season, they had the most goal kicks in the Premier League. 341. So if they're not going to sing We Want Brucey Out, maybe they could sing Champions of Goal Kicks, You'll Never Sing That, to the other 19 teams.
I would love to watch the DVD of Newcastle United's 341 goal kicks.
Maybe they got prettier once Graham Jones arrived.
Well, they should go from shortest to longest, yeah. You know, the little tappy ones, and then finishing with just lumping it up the field. I have them 17th. Philippe?
Dare I say that? I have them 20th.
Right. Barry?
17th for me as well.
Mark?
18th.
Okay, Norwich City, promoted from the Championship. Daniel Farke, their manager, home to Liverpool on Saturday. They've brought in quite a lot of players, including Ben Gibson, centre-back from Burnley, Billy Gilmore in on loan, Angus Gunn, son of Brian. So that's nice, isn't it? Brian Gunn has been in touch to say, given Norwich start against the last two champions, followed by Leicester and Arsenal, will they be effectively, if not mathematically, relegated by mid-September, cut adrift at the foot of the table despite everyone complimenting their lovely football? Barry?
That's a very good question. I presume people will compliment their lovely football, as I mean, they were patronised to within an inch of their lives the last time they were in the Premier League, but their finish to the season was pretty embarrassing and their defence was an absolute shambles. They've brought in quite a few players, most of whom I'm going to happily admit I've never heard of, apart from Ben Gibson and Billy Gilmore. I think the most money they've paid for anyone is 10 million, so it's players around it. Between 5 and 10 million mark. Gilmore is obviously in on loan. They've lost Emi Buendia to Aston Villa. I think he'll be a huge loss for them. I know one Norwich supporting friend of mine was absolutely furious he left to what she saw as a team who are sort of on the same level as Norwich. I think she's deluding herself on that front. I'm a fan of Daniel Farke. He signed a 4-year deal this summer, so that, you know, he's committed quite a lot of time to them, and if he stays for the duration of that contract, and I think they've had a pre-season COVID outbreak as well, which isn't very helpful, but I'm not optimistic about their chances of staying in the division.
And they've lost Buendia, and also Oliver Skipp was brilliant apparently for them on loan last year, Mark, and he's gone. So it's pressure on Gilmore. I was surprised Chelsea let Gilmore go, But it'll be interesting to see. He seems key for them, Mark.
Yeah, I would say so. And I suppose the fact that Farker likes to play sort of progressive football helps Norwich in that regard, really, in terms of what Premier League loans they're able to achieve. Maybe Chelsea would have looked at the way that Skip sort of grew up, I suppose, at Norwich last year, and has come back, according to all reports, at Spurs, like a completely different player, much more confident. For Gilmore, just taking a small step down could actually sort of be a real big springboard for him. I agree that Buendia was, you know, superb in the Championship last season, and how they replace him will be key. Rashica's comes in from the Bundesliga, did well in a struggling Bremen team, and also the Greek winger that they've signed, Tzolis, is highly rated and they're quite excited about his arrival as well. I thought they were quite good champions last season, and what Barry was saying about how on yesterday's pod about how many bad teams there are in the Premier League, I agree with that, and I think that gives Norwich, albeit is going to be close, I think that gives them a decent chance of staying up.
Philippe, a fact on Norwich City, please.
Yes, a fact about Norwich City and about their tutelar bird, the canary.
Yes.
Okay, they call the canaries because they have a yellow jersey, but what people don't necessarily know is that they have a yellow jersey because of canaries. It goes the other way around, because Norwich was the breeding center of canaries in England. And I think still remains up to a point, because it was Flemish immigrants who came into the country in the 18th century, brought their canaries along. And so it became an emblematic a bird for the city. And beautifully, there is actually one species of canary called the Norwich canary, which, funnily enough, has got a white breast. So there you go.
It's a wonderful fact.
Very patronizingly, everybody would like them to stay up. Mm. There are many people, you know, sort of third or fourth favorite team. But one of the things that they really deserve a lot of credit for is the way that they've stuck with Daniel Farker and also puts paid to this idea that changing managers who get relegated is a good idea. And in fact, if you look at recently, Burnley with Dyche, Fulham with Scott Parker, who at the beginning was just an interim manager, now Norwich with Farker, have been rewarded for sticking to a manager they believed in. So good luck to him and good luck to them.
19th for me, Mark.
I've got them 17th.
Barry.
19th.
Philippe.
17th.
All right. Southampton came 15th last year. Ralph Hasenhüttl, the manager, aware. Everton on Saturday. They've lost Danny Ings, of course. They brought in Adam Armstrong and Armando Broja. Armstrong from Blackburn and Broja from Chelsea as replacements. Also lost Ryan Bertrand, James Ward-Prowse. Apparently Tottenham are sniffing around him. Chris Packham has been in touch. Presumably not that one, but could be. I think he's a Southampton. Is he a Southampton fan? Or is he a Bristol City fan? I forget. Anyway, let's hope it's Chris Packham, who enjoyed that short piece we did on canaries and has become a listener since that moment. Are Southampton in trouble, Mark?
Yes, in as much as I think if they lost Ward-Prowse, that would definitely be one too many. Look like they've got sort of disinterested owners at the moment, or certainly ones that can't keep pace with, you know, a lot of the other Premier League spenders. If you go through sort of the spine of the team, if you know the Vestergaard's on his way to Leicester, Ings has already departed. If you lose the midfielder, the captain of that team, sort of the one that makes them tick, so dangerous from set pieces as well, I do think that it will be a difficult job. Where I think that they are sort of blessed, I suppose, is that I still believe in Hasenhüttl, the coach. I think he's somebody that's got an identity, a plan and a way of working that can keep Southampton up as long as he's given the tools to do the job. Last season, they finished really badly, but they were probably a team impacted more by that sort of fixture congestion more than most others because of the way that they play. They just couldn't sustain what they were trying to do. In the first half of matches, they looked quite good and then they just ran out of gas. I quite like Adam Armstrong as a signing. Scored a lot of goals in the Championship last season. Shot volume was really high. they'll be hoping he settles quicker than Shea Adams did, because it took him a significant time to kind of get used to Premier League life. But I'd be expecting more from him as well now as well. So I would be concerned. I understand why Southampton fans are worried. But sort of going back to the earlier point, I think there are a lot of bad teams in the Premier League, and having a good coach can sort of keep you just about out of trouble.
John has emailed, being a Saints fan, I was naturally disappointed that the local "he's one of our own lads" Danny Ings decided to throw himself through the door marked "do one to Villa" last week. But all is forgiven now that Danny has unwittingly helped to unleash the potential for the greatest bit of commentary tomfoolery ever known on the South Coast, with a potential front three of Stuart Armstrong, Che Adams and Adam Armstrong. The options are many. Armstrong to Adams, into Armstrong, Adams, Armstrong, Adam Armstrong, goal. and also, you know, with Ings going to Aston Villa, throwing a bit of Mings to Ings, back to Mings to Ings, we're away. So, you know, these are the things we look for in football. Barry, your fears for the Saints. I mean, they didn't even make your table yesterday. So, you know, anything is a bonus, right?
Yeah, I think they'll be fine, to be honest. Although, Mark has now reduced my confidence in their ability to stay up. But I'll be honest, I don't have a whole lot more to add.
Well, you don't need to, you know. There we are, fine. Philippe?
I don't have much more to add. Again, the ownership situation is not something that fills me with confidence, because believe it or not, the guy I was talking about, without mentioning his name, about Newcastle, is also a guy who was interested in Southampton. My goodness. And it seems to have been the case for quite a while now that the ownership, the people in place, are basically trying to find a way to get rid of the club, to sell the club. That doesn't bode well. But I still think that the fact of having a manager who is very much a top 10 manager is going to be enough for them to do it. He'll find the solutions.
15th for me, Barry.
Having omitted them completely first time around, I now have them in at ninth.
Ninth? Wow. Mark?
14th.
Barry, an interesting fact.
Southampton were the first English club ever to tour South America. In 1904, they travelled to Argentina and won games against Alumni, Belgrano and Britannicos by a combined score of 29-4. And then they beat a Uruguayan combined 11 by 8-1. And in his book, Passion of the People, Tony Mason wrote of the touring party, "They aroused the admiration of local followers of the great winter game as no other team has succeeded in doing."
Well, I have them as 12th, by the way.
Oh, why did I not ask you?
No.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's all right.
No. It's important. I've asked you to do the preparation. I should at least let you show your work, shouldn't
That's
I?
That's right.
Here
never
we are.
Mind.
Philippe, to the class. Southampton, 12th. Right, that'll do for part two. Part three begins with Tottenham Hotspur.
Hello, everybody. I'm in a radio studio, but just before you get to part three, you may hear a bit of background noise in Mark Langdon's house. It is the summer holidays, so it is a pod debut for the Langdon children. Otherwise, we hope that that adds to your enjoyment of part three of today's podcast.
Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. So Spurs came seventh last year. Their manager is Nuno Espirito Santo, home to Man City, 4:30 on Sunday. Is the entire Tottenham chat whether Kane stays or leaves, Mark? Or is it slightly more nuanced than that?
I feel like it is. You're talking about a team that would completely change with the sale of one player. And, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be for the worse, because, you know, if you did get in 130, 140, 150 million, you're then banking on the sporting director being able to make maybe the team better. But certainly, I think it is really, to such a large extent, what happens with Harry Kane. I mean, he was the top goal scorer in the Premier League last season and the top assist maker. They haven't got another centre forward as such. I mean, Son has played up front in pre-season, a very different forward, but, you know, even sort of the backup, Vinicius, Carlos Vinicius, departed, probably rightly so, didn't look up to the standard. So I think a lot of it does depend on Harry Kane. I would say that I think they've made an outstanding signing at the back in Christian Romero, who I'm surprised he's gone to Tottenham. He seemed very keen to go to Spurs. You know, it was obviously a lot of money, but he was definitely one of the best defenders in Italy last season. He was voted the best. I mean, you know, I'm not entirely sure. There were a couple of Inter players as well that maybe were there, but he was certainly one of the best. Very aggressive. Played for Argentina at the Copa America. I think they've improved for having him at the back as well. So they're a better team defensively. They've still got quite good forwards. The midfield, I think, will be boosted by Skip coming back. Højbjerg had a very good Euros. So there are reasons to be positive, but so much of it rests on Harry Kane. And I also think that kind of the Nuno situation, I think most Spurs fans were disappointed when he arrived. They've kind of got used to the fact that he's the coach now, and maybe, you know, he wasn't what they were after initially, but I think it could have been a lot worse, where they were kind of shopping in sort of the middle of the summer. So there were
in Gattuso land.
Gattuso land, and even Paolo Fonseca land. I wasn't convinced by him either. So I think that Tottenham, they're not going to finish in the top four in my book. Whether they finish fifth or sort of eighth probably depends on whether Harry Kane stays.
Barry, does Nuno have an advantage in that he isn't Jose Mourinho?
Oh, absolutely, I think. But I wonder how he feels knowing that the fans know he was, you know, whatever, seventh or eighth choice. Things had got very stale under him at Wolves last season. They weren't much fun to watch. And I'd be interested to see how he gets on. You know, the Kane caveat is obviously a huge one. I think Brian Gill is a good signing from Sevilla. And we were talking about Oliver Skip earlier. I believe he's been sort of playing in midfield for all the pre-season games and has been playing well. So he may become a force for them. But I wouldn't give them a prayer of finishing the top four.
I think this is one of the teams I really struggled to make any kind of prediction, because, you know, as we were saying, you know, it's all about whether Kane stays or not. When a player has got such a huge impact, influence on the team, be in terms of goals scored or goal created, and especially since the relationship forward is among the forwards is between him and Son, well, you think if you break that, this is a huge problem. Then, if you break that, then there is the uncertainty around Lautaro Martinez, who would be a wonderful signing, by the way. But it seems that finally Inter are playing hard to get. You know, now the Lukaku transfer is all but done. They might not be in need of as much money as we thought they were. They still need an awful lot. So it's a really difficult world to call. And with Kane staying, you think, well, yeah, they could challenge for the top four. There's no reason why not, because again, Christian Romero is really a superb signing. And actually, you would say an improvement on Toby Alderweireld, the Toby Alderweireld of last season, that is. So yes, I mean, I don't know. I'm not in between two chairs. I'm about between 12 chairs. I don't quite know. And how are they going to play with Nuno? Are we going to see a similar tactical organization to the one that we saw with Wolves? This kind of, waiting game that Wolves played possession. I don't know. I mean, I've got more question marks alongside Tottenham. Actually, that's the extent of my prep on Tottenham. It's the question mark followed by two question marks followed by an exclamation mark.
I've got them fifth. Barry?
Eighth.
Mark?
Got them sixth at the moment.
Philly?
I think I've got the, let me find that. I've got them eighth as well.
Interesting fact, Mark, for Tottenham.
Tottenham's record defeat came in 1995 in the much-loved Intertoto Cup. when they were beaten 8-0 by Cologne, a Cologne team that had, according to the Spurs goalkeeper on the day, Chris Day, 14 players that had played in the 94 World Cup. The Spurs first team were playing a pre-season friendly that day in Denmark, so they cobbled together some youth team players, and in the words of one of their experienced players, a mercenary who turned up just to pick up a bit of cash. That player that played in Tottenham's record defeat, most Spurs fans will know, but maybe others won't. Alan Pardew was part of that Tottenham team that was beaten 8-0 by Cologne.
A ringer. Call yourself, is that what they say? Just say you're Chris Waddle. Exactly. It'll be fine. Now, Watford then, promoted from the Championship. Their manager is Sisko. Quite the move from recording the Thong song in the year 2000, where he swept the board at the Billboard Awards. They're home to Villa on Saturday at 3. Signings of note. Josh King has come in from Everton. Barry told me that last week. Danny Rose has come in from Spurs. A bit of uncertainty over their squad. Nathaniel Chalobah, Will Hughes haven't signed yet. They've made a few signings. I have them bottom of the league. That is largely down to ignorance, Barry, I would say, more than anything else.
Well, I think you're coming to the wrong place for enlightenment, because it occurred to me while I was sort of doing my homework for this, I don't think I saw a single minute of Watford playing last season. I know nothing about their manager, but I've since discovered that he won, as well as all those R&B awards, he also won the Georgian League with Dynamo Tbilisi, which, you know, you can't beat that kind of pedigree. He's a former Valencia and Real Betis winger. But upon his arrival last Christmas, and Watford's owners are renowned for their sort of eccentric recruitment policy, Watford really turned things around. They took 57 points from 26 matches, in which they conceded just 15 goals. So that's pretty impressive. And beyond that, my main note before getting stuck into Watford is Troy Deeney still there? And the answer to that question is yes, but they won't. He plays an increasingly peripheral role, and they'll be looking to Shmila Sarr, who's probably their standout player, and Joao Pedro for goals.
Troy Deeney is there, but also lots of sons of footballing fathers. Maurizio Pochettino, son of Maurizio, but spelt with a Z, not a C. Matty, son of Jamie Pollock, and Henry, son of Dennis Wise, all at Watford. Mark, could you furnish these two ignoramuses, that's me and Barry, Philippe, don't worry, with a bit more information?
Yeah, I mean, I think I was expecting more from Watford in the transfer market. Just the fact that, you know, that the Pozzos are, as an ownership, are renowned for being able to find talent and sort of from all around the world, and from, I suppose satellite clubs is probably the wrong word to use, and certainly Udinese fans wouldn't like to be referred to as that. But, you know, they're other clubs. They share the players around the teams that they own. So I've been disappointed with their transfers in. The midfielder, Lauzer from Nantes, I think is somebody that I don't know if Philippe knows more about, but he's somebody that I think could step up to the Premier League. He definitely, I think, improves them in midfield. I felt they were well organised last year under Isco, so the issue for them, I think, will be in scoring the goals. And they've got a lot of forwards, and it's whether you can kind of put one of them down to even reach double figures, because not easy to score sort of 10-12 goals in the Premier League. Maybe that comes in Joao Pedro. They absolutely have to keep Sarr. I mean, he's the difference maker for them out wide. Emmanuel Dennis, who comes in from Club Bruges, has scored in the Champions League.
Son of Les as well, so another famous son.
this is a team, I think, that it's a big squad. I would of the three that have come up, I've got more sort of doubts about them than the other two, I think.
Barry, an interesting fact, please.
It occurred to me, Watford are called the Hornets because of their yellow and black strip, but their crest is famously a moose, and I've sort of was wondering why. And it turns out it's not a moose, it's a hart, and a hart is a male deer, and it represents the hart part of Hertfordshire. So that is why their crest is a moose and not a hornet. But the Watford badge of the 60s and 70s did have a hornet on it.
I have them bottom. Mark, where have you got them?
19th.
Barry?
Bottom.
Philippe?
18th.
At West Ham then, David Moyes the manager, 6th last year, away to Newcastle on Sunday at 2. Terry says the last time West Ham had a pre-season this successful was when Avram Grant was manager and the season ended in relegation. So should I be worried? They've got European football. They have kept hold of Declan Rice, which is huge at the moment, but not a lot being talked about because there were rumours about him going to Chelsea. Myolo Nir says, whose fans are the worst? Speculated on that yesterday. Could you do the pre-seasons by where they placed last season, not alphabetically? As a Hammers fan, I always feel like you're fatigued when you get to us. Yeah, we are phoning it in now. Philippe, your thoughts on West Ham? They did so well last year. You know, Souček and Soufal were brilliant. Antonio led the line so well. Declan Rice was excellent. And their defence was sort of surprisingly good when you looked at who was there. Can they do it again?
Well, they've kept the same manager. They've kept the same players, more or less. They haven't really strengthened the team that much. I think the only name that will mean anything to anyone would be Craig Dawson. I'm a little bit... I think it was a bit of a one-off last season. And I know I'm not the first person to have to have noticed that or remarked that. The fact that the absence of fans from the stadium certainly was not a problem for them and that they might have benefited from it in many ways, given how difficult the atmosphere can be at the London Stadium in some cases. Yes, Europe being part of the equation, that's a big problem. They do not have, I think, the squad to play both competitions as seriously as perhaps the fans would like to. And I do think it's going to put some, extra pressure and unwanted pressure on this particular team. And last year as well, it was a question of there was a dynamic within that group with Moyes. Is that you really felt that this team was doing exactly what was expected of it every single game almost. As in, against the bigger teams, they struggled, they were not fantastic, they lost, what's the problem? But they were excellent against team which you would normally put between the 8th and the 16th place, and this is where actually they build their success. Can they do that in this particular context, with the added pressure of the crowd, with the Europa League as well? I'm not so sure. I don't think they're going to be in any danger whatsoever, but I can't see them doing something similar to what they did last season.
And Mark, Jesse Lingard gave them such a sort of impetus when he turned up. And I sort of hoped that they would get that as a sign. It doesn't look like he'll end up there. I think that might make a bit of a difference for them as well.
I think it's a massive difference. Yeah, I mean, he was, he was the catalyst, I think, for that final push. You know, particularly when Antonio was out injured, he was playing almost as a centre forward and as the number 10 at times. And agree with Philippe that the European angle, I think, is going to be a difficult one because the squad is thin. They haven't got anybody to replace Antonio. Antonio has developed into a really fine Premier League forward and somebody that can get you your double figures and is a horrible player to play against. But they haven't got replacement for him, and he's had injury problems in the past. So I think their first 11 is sort of one of the better ones outside of sort of the obvious sort of seven. But I look and it's really thin beyond that. And the owners, I think, are trying to take liberties, really. They need to put a bit more money in to help David Moyes. I think Moyes deserves that backing after what happened last season to get them into the Europa League and then not try to build on that. Feels like a real disappointment. Benrahma, I'm expecting better from him. He's had a fine pre-season. Started towards the end of the last season, you saw bits of why people were so excited about him at Brentford. But outside, like I said, outside of the front 11, they just haven't got much depth, apart from in goal, where Areola is a really good understudy, if he's to be that, for Fabianski. But, they've got more good goalkeepers than they have centre-forwards. That's not a great place to be.
11th for me, Philippe.
Let me check. 13th for me.
Barry?
11th.
Mark?
I feel like I was a bit negative there. 10th.
And a fact, please, Mark.
Okay, so last season West Ham had a positive goal difference, but that doesn't happen too often for them in the Premier League. The last time they had back-to-back positive goal differences in the top flight was the 1982-83, 83-84 season. So regression is likely.
Wolves, then. Bruno Lage, their manager, came 13th last year away at Leicester. 3 o'clock kickoff on Saturday. I haven't really signed anybody of note or anyone that I could nod to apart from Ryan Alt-Nouri. But whenever I hear his name, he played last year, I always hear Leighton Orient. I mean, not quite the same, but then I you can't just play Leighton Orient at left back, can you? Langdon, some honesty here. You forgot about Wolves, didn't you?
In terms of where I put them in the table, yeah, I've one spot left, so that they've gone there. I still feel like that's about right when we get to that reveal in terms of where they are. I think Trincao's an interesting signing from Barcelona. It's probably too much of a step up when he went from Portuguese football to Barcelona. Of course, Barcelona just obsessed with signing players and then realised they couldn't afford them. And so he was one that they were able to get off the books. Bruno Lage comes in, really made a good start when he was first in charge at Benfica. Then it went wrong. They needed freshening up. They also need some players. You know, up front, Raul Jimenez, great to have him back, but they haven't got any real depth for him. Cotrone's on his way to Italy. Rafa Mir's on his way to Atletico Madrid. I'm presuming that's because they've got somebody lined up, but until they get that them sort of new signings in that they need, hard to see them really kicking on under the new manager. I don't think Lage has been supported well enough for this change of style that sort of is being muted around Molineux.
I was going to say, Lage, it's very much which manager you're going to get. The one who arrived, I think, in January at Benfica as a caretaker manager, suddenly completely changed the whole team and the way they played. They had a fantastic series of results. They beat, I think, Sporting, Braga, Porto in superb fashion and won the title. But then the next season, all the wheels came off. And he had, in fact, one of the worst series of results that Benfica has had for decades, and not years, decades. And you wonder, well, okay, which one are we getting here? I mean, it's both, this appointment was both one of the most unexpected and the most expected, given obviously the links that Mr. Lage has got to certain person who wields a lot of influence at Wolves. I think the return of Raul Jimenez, I mean, player whom I love and who has shown some form already in the preseason games, I mean, is such a huge bonus. You talk about Van Dijk and Gomez feeling like new signings. I mean, come on. He is a good Raul Jimenez is truly one of the best center forwards in English and European football. So, which is why I was quite pessimistic for them. Before the good news came in that he was back. Now I think I can look at this season with a little bit more optimism, perhaps, than would have been the case otherwise.
13th for me, Baz?
13th. Just one point. They have a very difficult start to the season. Their first three games in the league are against Leicester, Tottenham and Man United. So they could be adrift with Norwich and relegated by the end of August.
Philippe, where are you putting them?
11th.
Mark?
13th as well.
13th. A fun fact, Philippe.
I believe that Wolves are the only team, a certain English team, to take the field wearing a silk jersey, which I think is really, really classy.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, and that was in that famous game against Honved in 1953, which played a part in the creation of the European Cup, because Gabriel Anou of L'Equipe was so incensed by seeing the Daily Mail say, headlining, Wolves are the champions of Europe, that he said, no, we've got to show that they are not. So he started the whole thing about the European Cup. But they had chosen this silk shirt, which is a gold silk shirt, because the game was under floodlights and they thought it would look better. And it looked fantastic if you look at pictures of that game. Unfortunately, is the only time that they ever wore that shirt. And the reason why I know that is because I saw it at the National Football Museum. There was a Wolves exhibition there. And it is one of the most amazingly beautiful jerseys you will ever see. It's just gorgeous. So I'm all for the return of silk shirts, please.
I suspect an army of kit men would be very much against that, because I've three silk shirts I bought on my travels in India, which I love, but they are a bugger to wash. You can't just bung them in the machine.
But imagine the replica, you know, the replica jersey, the market would explode. It would be a new thing.
What was the design of, what was sort of the design of your silk shirts, Barry? Were they plain, or were they sort of, you know, were they sort of representing the area? I would just imagine sort of you living in Goa for the rest of your life and sort of culturally appropriating Indian wear now.
No, they're just plain. I'll wear one for the live show tonight.
Oh, perfect. I had a question for you, Philippe, about Lionel Messi.
Oh,
it's worth mentioning Messi, I guess. Probably should do it a couple more pods in a row. Adam Sage in The Times went to find French people in Paris who didn't have a clue what was happening. And he went to... He sat on a bench in Gaston Batty Square in Montparnasse and chatted to David Sayer, 46, who describes himself as a former philosopher and a singing poet, who said he knew absolutely nothing about the transfer. And I remember when we did your Life and Times, you were, you know, you're a philosopher. Can you be a former philosopher? You know, is that like announced? David Sayer announces his retirement from international philosophy. You know, my thinking just wasn't, you know, my thinking's, I've lost a yard of thought, so I'm just not going to philosophize anymore.
Well, yes, you can do that, I suppose. Because in France, philosopher is a profession.
Right.
Because philosophy is taught as a subject in all schools, all secondary schools. Hmm. So there is a real market there for philosophy teachers, for philosophers, professional philosophers. I was one, not for long.
I presume if you were a philosopher and you're still thinking about stuff, you're still a philosopher.
No, you're not.
All right.
You're
okay.
Not. You know, it's like you're a player, you're on the pitch, you're a player, you retire, you're no longer a player. I'm terribly sorry.
Okay.
You can still know a thing or two about the game, but, you know, it passes you by, perhaps.
Presumably, once you retire, you miss the coffee shop banter.
Yeah.
About Kantian positivism and whatnot.
And having your shoes cut up and someone defecating in your gloves. I'm sure it's the same.
Which happens all the time in philosophy classes. Yes.
Doesn't it? Derrida. Oh my God, he was filthy.
He loved his football.
Yeah.
He wanted to be a goalkeeper. That was his greatest ambition.
He should have just thought about it a bit more, shouldn't he?
Went unrealized. Yes, absolutely. So, you know, philosophy. You know, goalkeepers, we could have had Albert Camus in goal, no problem, he was a keeper, and Derrida as a number two, or even a Scott Carson figure.
Oh, it'd be nice to have a philosopher. And the third keeper is Immanuel Kant. There you are. Anyway, that'll do for today. Mark, thank you.
Thank you, Max.
Barry, thank you.
You're welcome.
Philippe, thank you.
Merci, Max.
We'll be back for the live show tonight. Hope to see you there. If you can't catch it or you're listening too late, you can always watch for the next week ahead. I've tweeted out the link, I mean, far too many times that I'm now blocked by everybody. But see you there. And if not, we'll see you after the first weekend of Premier League games on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.